I had been writing every single day on the internet for 10 years. I have practiced and done this and generated the result that everyone else wants. Now let me tell you all of the things that I learned doing it.
You told me that this is bringing in between $600,000 to $700,000 per month, sometimes up to $1 million, correct?
Yep. There's a reason why we have no competition. A lot of people will call courses or education programs scams.
That's kind of always been my impression, right? It's hard to break that.
Education is whatever you make of it. We've had students join PGA as a complete beginner and a year later now are running ghostwriting agencies of their own doing 50, 60, 70, 80, 90 grand a month.
What do you find is most effective in like helping those people understand like, no, you have to give some things up. You have to compromise if you want to make a living doing this.
This is one of my favorite topics.
I want to say, I think I was first made aware of you. I might've mentioned this to you before, when I interviewed this guy, Pejman Milani, about a year and a half ago, and he had done Ship 30 for 30. And, you know, I'm generally skeptical of course products, online educational products, plenty of good stuff out there, plenty of bad stuff. I think I respect what you do. But I was really impressed by his story. He had this story where he was around, he was like early 40s, and around his 40th birthday, he had been reading his journal from his 30th birthday, animation teacher, at a high school in Texas. And in his 30th birthday, in his journal, he'd written how he wanted to make something for himself. And he never really was. He wasn't writing anything. He wasn't animating things for himself. And his students would ask him, PJ, what do you make? And he was like, oh, I teach you guys. And then on his 40th birthday, he goes in and he writes that again. And he goes back to his 30th birthday and he finds this note. And he's like, God, I can't do this again on my 50th birthday. Anyways, long way of saying he does Ship 30 for 30. And then he starts doing it. And pretty quickly, he kind of figures out a format that's like illustrating these ideas, you know, and he blows up. And now he's got like 200,000 followers on LinkedIn and newsletter subscriber, whatever. So that's how I heard of you. And that's kind of what brings me into this conversation, is that you are somebody who, you know, is able to produce an educational product that stands above a lot of what's out there on the internet.
Well, thank you for that. PJ is great. That was a great success story. I wish I could take more credit, but Ship 30 grew into something that I don't think I or even my business partner, Dickie, really thought that it would grow into. I mean, I started it with him just because I thought it was a cool idea and it spoke to my own writing journey. You know, I started writing on the internet when I was a teenager, but I really got started right after I graduated from college. And in 2014, this is a story I've told 1,000 times. I challenged myself to write one Quora answer every day for a year. And I figured, you know, worst case scenario, I do this thing I enjoy and I get better. Best case scenario, something happens. And so when Ship 30 came around and I saw Dickie building that almost a decade later, you know, that spoke to that experience that did end up changing my life. And, you know, yeah, there's a big educational component in Ship 30, but to be honest, it's funny because I know when I say this, it seems very easy to devalue it, but it is the most important thing, which is for a beginner, you actually don't really need education. You don't really need to know the answers or the reasons why you do everything that you do. You don't need to know the secrets. You don't need to know the hacks, the tricks. Like, all of those things come after a very basic foundational starting place, which is everyone just needs encouragement. You know, and the metaphor I like using is I feel like, you know, and I'll speak in the context of writing online, everyone always wants to know what's the platform, what's the hack, what's the way to tap into the algorithm, what's the quick fix trick, advanced tactic. And the reality is that's a little bit like someone saying, you know, how do I shoot a perfect turnaround jump shot?
Like, how do I get off Michael the couch Jordan? And run a marathon tomorrow?
Yeah. And it's like, well, how about we start with you going to the gym? And they're like, no. But like, how do I do that? And it's like, I literally can't tell you anything until I get you physically into the gym. Mm-hmm. And so much of Ship 30 and why it's become so successful is because it gives every person the fundamental thing that they all need, which is you just need someone to tell you it's okay. and I believe in you, and nothing bad is going to happen. And then people do that for 30 days, and then all these amazing outcomes happen, you know?
Yeah. I mean, which I think part the big part of that, right, is the cohort-based course versus maybe just like a solo email course, which we'll get into that in a second. But to spare you having to, you know, try to put in any of the bits that you've said a million times before in your own content and under the podcast, my summary of what you do in the history of your career is you were like a teenage World of Warcraft whiz, and you were writing on World of Warcraft blogs, and then you get into kind of bodybuilding, and you're participating in bodybuilding forums, this kind of thing. And then you're in college, you're studying fiction writing. You're kind of like, I'm kind of disillusioned by the fact that there doesn't really seem to be a way to make money out of this. You get out, you join an ad agency, you're doing that for a little while. You start doing the Quora thing. You become the most viewed writer on Quora, I believe. And then you start doing ghostwriting. You start this ghostwriting agency with a friend. You scale that to like 2 million a year, I believe. And then you shut that down. You've got 10,000 in the bank. You failed to save. You'd grown this business. You'd hadn't really put aside for yourself. I'm probably missing a few details. And then
you're nailing it.
Okay, good. Around 2020, you link up with Dickie Bush, your business partner. You guys make Ship 30 for 30. It grows slowly and then quite quickly. And now it's one of the most popular writing education programs on the internet. And now you've also got, so you've got Ship 30 for 30. You've got Typeshare, which is a writing and multi-platform publishing software. You've got Premium Ghostwriting Academy, which is another writing course for ghostwriting specifically. You've got Write with AI, which is a paid newsletter. You've got Different Publishing, which I understand is like an audiobook publishing platform. And then you have written 9 or 10 books. And this is kind of the full shtick, the full story, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. When you say it back like that, it makes me realize how much I did not have it figured out at any one of those chapters. But I just kept trying things, you know.
You kept shipping 365 for 365 or whatever, if you will. Okay, I just wanted to get that out of the way because I don't want you to have to fall back into explaining these things that you've explained a million times before. Yeah. So this business portfolio that I just explained, I want to talk about that for a little bit, and then we'll get more into the micro. I think I want to get back into the Ship 30 for 30 cohort-based course stuff. You told me that this overall portfolio right now, I'm always interested in figuring out how the people I interview make their living, right? You told me that this is bringing in between $600,000 to $700,000 per month. I imagine that's not to you personally. That's what the business's revenue overall, sometimes up to $1 million, correct?
Yep. Yeah, I'd say our average is probably right now, our average is around $600,000 a month. Mm-hmm. And then depending on when we do product drops or if one vertical just has an amazing month, we'll have pops up to $1 million. So our current goal is figuring out, you know, so what needs to happen to get from $500,000, $600,000, $700,000 a month to a consistent $1 million a month.
Yeah.
That's our current goal.
What's the most performant of these businesses?
Premium Ghostwriting Academy makes up 80% of that. It's our biggest vertical by far. It has grown tremendously. It's also the one that has the most operational complexity.
Mm.
So Ship 30 as a business was very simple, you know, and it was me, Dickie. We had a early team member, Daniel, who's an absolute rock star. And we maybe had like an assistant or two, VA here and there. And Ship 30 as a model was interesting because it was cohort based. And so if there was 10 people in a cohort or 100 people in a cohort or 1,000 people in a cohort, like your marginal change in operational complexity was actually not that much. It was, you know, maybe we need to set up a couple more zaps or, you know, maybe we need to hire one or two VAs to do some of the things that we were doing, but just don't scale with more people, right?
Figuring out breakout groups or something.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And that model worked really well. And Ship 30 grew to $1 million a year business in the first year. And then on the back of that, we launched sort of this continuity program called Captain's Table, which was essentially Ship 30 had ended. Now you're looking to do other things on the back of your writing. You know, you want to start a newsletter, you want, you know, maybe launch a digital product, et cetera. And so we'll give you some education on that. And we'll do like a live session once a week. It's like just straight continuity. And when we added that in, the next year, Ship 30 grew to $2 million a year as a business, which was great. And that was a very I mean, that was a super small team. It was me, Dickie, and maybe four other people. And it was making amazing money. It was very profitable, like 85% margin, you know? But, you know, in hindsight, Dickie and I also realized, like, but we were also capped a little bit. There were things that we couldn't do because the reason, like, what eventually clicked for us is the reason why it was 85% margin was because we were still doing a lot of the roles, you know? And so when we started PGA, you know, PGA's operational complexity is completely different. It's evergreen, so someone can join at any time. It's high ticket, so people have very different expectations. In order to sell high ticket, that means you have to sell it over the phone, so we have a sales team. In order to get people on the phone and remind them to show up to their sales call and make sure that they're educated, we have to pre-educate them, so we have a whole marketing team. You know, once they join the program, we want them to instantly feel like the money that they invested in themselves was worth it. So we have a success team. We pair them with a coach, you know, so like it has been a huge learning for all of us that building something like that, that does the amount of revenue that it does, it is not just a little bit harder than Ship 30, you know, or it's not like twice as hard. It is literally like 10 times as hard. Mm. And so something we repeat over and over internally is that operational complexity is the moat, you know, that there's a reason why there is no other ghostwriting program. There's a reason why, like, we have no competition because we spend an exorbitant amount of money every month in the operational complexity that is that vertical.
How big is the team?
I think we're north of 30 at this point, maybe 32, 33, something like that.
Wow. One thing about, like, you, so it's this complex business, and you could have only really started it after Ship 30 for 30, I think. I was, just before we got on, I was listening to one of your Coffee with Cole podcast episodes, and this one, I think it was about a year old, and you're kind of breaking down the success of Ship 30 for 30 and how you've built it and the whole timeline. And you describe this process for validating educational products, really, which I found really kind of clear-eyed and wanted to bring up. So basically you say, like, you started by, you know, writing yourself, and then you taught friends, loved ones, like, oh, here's how I do this thing. You're helping individuals, and then, oh, now you're doing coaching calls, and now maybe you're doing calls with, oh, maybe 10 people, and you build the cohort-based course, and then the cohorts grow. And then once you have validated that, that then allows you to productize it in a different way, maybe with Premium Ghostwriting Academy. But yeah, I haven't got the chance to talk about educational products and who should make them and how they should be built, right, for a while here. So in terms of, like, how you validate that idea and grow it, maybe there's nothing else to say. It's just start with one person, then a few more, then more. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing that gets lost, and the reason why info or education products tend to have this, generally negative association. Like, a lot of people will call courses or education programs scams.
Which is what, and I think, as I was saying at the beginning, that's kind of always been my impression, right? It's hard to break that.
Yeah. And I get it through the lens that, first of all, education is whatever you make of it. You know, like, we have in the same program, we might have someone go through it and say, you know, well, this didn't help me at all. Mm-hmm. And then we have another person go through it and go, this literally changed my life, and every single thing that I wanted happened in a tenth of the time.
Yeah.
It's not that they had, like, a different curriculum than the other person, but it is largely dependent on what you choose to do with it, you know? But I think the reason why there's that association with info and education is because info and education is not this thing where you wake up in the morning and you ask yourself, oh, what would crush as a info product? And then let me go build it. That's what a lot of people do. And so they're trying to teach other people how to do things that they themselves have never done. They just think that that would make for a great product. People forget the reason Ship 30 grew so quickly is because I had been writing every single day on the internet for 10 years before we started Ship 30. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I had written thousands of articles on Quora. I had written thousands of columns for Inc. magazine. I had a decade of I have practiced and done this and generated the result that everyone else wants. Now let me tell you all of the things that I learned doing it. People also forget the reason that PGA, our premium ghostwriting academy, grew so quickly is because I built the first ghostwriting agency for founders and executives. I have spent 5,000 hours ghostwriting for CEOs and founders and investors and venture capitalists. I have trained dozens and dozens and dozens of writers that I've employed on how to ghostwrite like me so that I could scale my agency. So when we started PGA, it wasn't, oh, I think that if we had a ghostwriting curriculum, that would crush and we'll just, you know, wing it. It's like, no, I had years, like thousands of hours of my own frameworks developed. And then as soon as we package them up and share them, of course, people are going to get a high quality result because I've already gone through all of the hard work. And I think that's the important distinction with info and education is it's not, I think the best place to start if you want to get into any sort of education product is actually doing it for yourself and providing it as a service. Mm. Because you should actually do the work. And then info and education is just, well, let me package up how I do what I do. And then if you choose to go down that road, well, then there's all these different business models for info. You know, some people go the community route. Some people go low ticket digital product. Some people go high ticket group coaching. You know, then it becomes a game of, all right, so which business model is maybe best suited for your skills or best suited for the thing that you're trying to help someone accomplish?
Hi there. My name's Tom, and I'm the producer of the Creator Spotlight podcast. I'm just interrupting real quick to ask you to subscribe. I know you hear that a lot on YouTube, but look at this stat. Over the past 90 days, 75% of our watch time has come from people that aren't subscribed, which means there's a good chance that you're watching this and you watch our other episodes too, but you aren't subscribed yet. If that's you, do us a favor, subscribe to the channel. It will help us keep getting these great guests to share their knowledge and their insights with us and with you. Thank you. Back to the episode. And also, if you're on Apple or Spotify, please also follow and subscribe. Thank you.
I want to talk about ghostwriting a bit. So this is how I got my start in this career as well, right? I was a rhetoric and English major in college, and I didn't know how to make money doing that. And I decided I wasn't going to be a journalist because I couldn't figure out how to make money doing that. And so eventually, after messing around in kitchens for a couple of years, I went on Upwork and I realized, right, you got to take these gigs that pay you basically dirt to learn how to do it and to build the portfolio, et cetera. And I'm writing for like this, I don't know, somebody's personal camping project blog. Anyways, that's neither here nor there. But yeah, now I don't really ghostwrite anymore. But you teach people how to ghostwrite. And I think it is still a very popular industry that has not reached its peak, right? There's more and more people are trying to get on LinkedIn. There's like, I'm seeing job postings on LinkedIn for like, right, you know, head of CEO content for PayPal or ChatGPT, not for ChatGPT, but for PayPal. All a long way of asking, how do you see the state of ghostwriting as this category of work on the internet? What is that in 2025 going into 2026 compared to, say, what it was when you started over a decade ago?
I mean, the category has matured tremendously over the past 10 years. I started ghostwriting in 2016. Mm. In 2016, people were still saying that ghostwriting was like against the law. You know, I mean, I think about how much that category has matured. And I don't even think about it like ghostwriting, to be honest. Ghostwriting is a word that now more people understand and have associations with. And so it's a great thing for me to name and claim and build a company in. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I don't even think about it like ghostwriting. I think about it like, what is the demand? Like, just to say it very overtly.
It's copywriting. What
is the demand for business owners who want to scale themselves online? What is the demand for people who want to generate organic traffic? What is the demand for businesses that want to build trust with as many potential customers as possible? The demand for that outcome is infinite. It is infinite. And so there's something that's so funny to me when people say, you know, ghostwriting is a trend, or ghostwriters are going to get replaced by AI, or I don't understand who would hire a ghostwriter because that's cheating. It's like, okay, well, if hiring a ghostwriter is cheating, then so is hiring a YouTube editor, and so is hiring a social media manager. You know, like it, none of those things actually make sense. And the thing that I knew in 2016, and I know way more today, a decade later, is that every single person, not even wants to, now needs to build themselves on the internet. Mm-hmm. If you have an invisible presence, and if you aren't sharing the things that you've learned and your insights that you've gathered and the frameworks that you've built for yourself over your 20, 30, 40 year career on the internet, you are missing out. And people have to remember, in 2016, we didn't have Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos or Satya Nadella or all of these people like actively participating in the digital social conversation. Now they all do it. Mm-hmm. They tweet each other, you know? And so if you have that tier of person essentially signaling to everyone else, well, I'm active in this game. Every layer of CEO and founder and investor and podcaster and YouTuber and everyone, solopreneur, everyone looks at that and goes, well, I should too. Mm-hmm. And this thing isn't going away. Like the demand for this service is up and to the right in such a parabolic way. And I've known that. I've known that for 10 years and I'm still just pounding the table about it.
You're still making money off it. No, it's interesting that like focusing on the word ghostwriting is like, well, maybe it's less relevant as this word, but obviously useful for you and your brand, right? Like something I ask almost everybody who comes on here is how do you define the term creator? And with you, in researching you, I don't really see you use that word to describe yourself anywhere. Maybe I see digital writer, serial entrepreneur, right? I think these are some of the words on your website. But when I like try to fit you into that box, right, which basically the way I define it is anybody out there on the internet creating content, building an audience for it, and somehow monetizing it, or maybe a more simple way is just somebody putting stuff on the internet, right? But you're kind of like this like earlier era of creator where when you were on Quora, you're this Quora creator, right? And then after that, you become more of just a professional writer for hire, call it a ghostwriter, whatever. Then you become an agency owner, et cetera. But it's kind of what you're describing too, where like it all collapses. Even the word creator, I kind of think maybe in 10 years, maybe earlier, people won't really use it because it's almost irrelevant because everybody is publishing content to the internet. I don't know. There's not really a question in here. More of just like, it sounds like you're describing this kind of collapse of context, right? Like if ghostwriting was cheating and you wouldn't want to do it, well, like that describes somebody who, like for them, the point is the writing, right? Not the distribution of the message and like the meeting of an audience where they are. And that's kind of the same thing as this, the creator economy eating everything.
Yeah. I mean, so I'll share some commentary to your no question, but I have some thoughts, which is, I think people forget that the term creator was really a reflection of how technology had evolved. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I've been writing on the internet since 2007. So I've gotten to write and try writing and try lots of things in and around the world of writing on the internet for a very long time now. And so I've watched a lot of technologies and I've tried and experimented with a lot of technologies. And the term creator really started emerging when you had these tools that allowed one person to essentially do the V1 of lots of different things that in the past had required other people. So, you know, in the late 2000s or the early 2010s, if I wanted to launch a website with a paywall, or if I wanted to launch a paid newsletter, or if I wanted to create a digital product, right? Like there were all sorts of things that a single individual, especially an average individual like myself, that you can't really do that. Like I couldn't just go teach myself how to code mm-hmm. on a weekend to build the thing that I needed, right? People forget that before Stripe, like handling payments on the internet was very complicated. It was very hard. And so I think this term creator really, the way my interpretation of it and what I associate it with is really sort of like a full stack digital solopreneur type person.
Yes, I like that.
Right? And there's a lot to be said for that. There's a lot of freedom. That is a new type of person, a new type of creator that has emerged in only the last, you know, 5 to 8 years. It's still fairly new. Mm-hmm. But there's something, the reason why I think I don't typically use that word is because while that is amazing, and I think it works for a lot of people, and I encourage a lot of people to do it, if those tools were available to me as a 17-year-old, I wouldn't have even gone to college. I would have just been crushing it as a creator, you know? But I think what separates and where you graduate from there is dependent on the amount of operational complexity that you're willing to take on.
Yes.
You know, an individual creator, there's a reason why they tend to be limited to a couple business models. Because in order to build more advanced things, you literally can't do it all yourself. I could not run PGA as a solopreneur. It would be impossible, you know? And so if you want, or an agency, I could not run a full-blown agency servicing 80 clients around the world, generating millions of dollars as just an individual, right? And so who knows, maybe AI will change those numbers and, you know, there will be a version that is possible. But I like to think of that separation where creator is sort of you're doing everything yourself and there's pros, but you're also limited. And then if you're not a creator, you start to step into that, the more mature version, which is an entrepreneur or a serial entrepreneur where you're actually building things. And now you have bigger problems. Those bigger problems are, how do I convince other people to work with me? How do I keep other people motivated? How do I tolerate all these systems and build all these processes that I might have no idea how to build, but I got to go recruit the right people to help me build them, you know?
No, 100%. I mean, I like to say that any creator is like a potential media startup, right? Or other form of startup, like Mr. Beast, even people call him a creator because he's on YouTube, but I almost would
he's
not.
He's so far beyond.
Exactly.
That.
Yes. He is now just like, he's running multiple like multi-hundred-million-dollar companies, and he happens to be the face or the host of a lot of this content, but he is actually just a scaled media entrepreneur, right?
Yeah, just because Elon Musk has however many million followers, that doesn't mean he's a creator.
Precisely.
You know, I think there's this there's an intersection, obviously, and media is becoming a baseline skill for everyone. Mm-hmm. But I like to think of it as creators are typically solopreneurs or more limited in the business models that they can pursue. And again, that's great. It just means that you sort of have it. Being a creator is like having a higher leverage lifestyle business in which, you know, you built yourself your dream job, but you still have a job. Because you got to show up and you got to do your song and dance because like that's what puts food on the table, right? And and there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that. But it is a different path than if you were to go the entrepreneur route and actually go, how do I build a team? How do I build systems? How do I build this thing that can function without me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in doing that, in building a team and building a thing that can function without you, and you keep talking about operational complexity, this is something that you were stressing too when last time we talked. I would love if you could give me like two or three moments in your career where you have chosen to add that complexity and kind of the struggle of achieving it, right? Of like, you know, at X point in time, you decided to hire a person and that was hard at first. And then anyways, but two or three moments in your career where you've added that complexity and kind of the struggle of integrating it.
I mean, the first big one was the moment I went from ghostwriting for myself to saying, I'm going to build a ghostwriting agency. You know, I mean, in hindsight, 2016, I was 26 years old. I had just quit my full-time job as a low wage copywriter at an ad agency. And I fell into ghostwriting, and 3 months later, you know, I'm making 20 grand a month. So that's $250,000 a year working like 4 hours a day, ghostwriting for CEOs. I mean, those last couple months of 2016, in hindsight, I'm like, wow, I was living the dream. I was just, my burn rate, my expenses were super low. I was still living in my, you know, dumpy little studio apartment in Chicago. I was just saving tons of more money than I'd ever saved in my whole life, you know? And I wasn't even working that hard, and I was doing something I enjoyed, and I was getting paid a premium to practice writing, and I got to talk to these super smart people, ask them whatever questions I want, and then send them an invoice. Mm-hmm. It was crazy to me. I thought it was the coolest job ever. And then I would have the whole rest of my day to work on other writing. And so the decision to scale into an agency was really a decision to give up all of those freedoms and benefits, you know? And the thinking, at the time I convinced one of my best friends to do it with me. He was graduating from business school and he wanted to start a business because he wanted to apply all the things he was learning, you know? And I had this thing that was working. So we were like, let's build an agency together. And really that decision was a commitment to building a whole set of skills that neither one of us had yet, you know? And the reality is there were a lot of things that worked, you know? We scaled it to millions of dollars in revenue and we hired, at our height, we had 23 full-time employees. We had 80 plus clients around the world. I mean, it was on paper, like we did it. We built a business. But at the same time, that didn't mean that we were good at the things that we were doing. You know, I can see now in hindsight, I hadn't yet figured out how to articulate how I do what I do. I wasn't as good yet at training other writers. I wasn't as good yet at managing my own stress and emotions. I wasn't a good enough leader yet. I was young. I was 27 years old. I didn't even know what I wanted out of my life. How was I supposed to give other people career paths? You know what I mean? We didn't understand systems and processes enough. This was also pre-AI. Yeah. So there were all these things that now are super easy, like transcribing calls. And we were spending thousands of dollars every month sending our recorded Zoom calls over to, you know, some company in another country to transcribe them and then send them back to us. So it's like that commitment to building all those skills at the time was extremely painful. Mm-hmm. It was extremely painful. It was very hard. And I gave up a lot of freedom and I gave up a lot of money in order to do that. But that's the journey. Cause then, mm-hmm. you know, 5 years later, 7 years later, I start PGA and I am older. I am more equipped. I can handle stress at a different level. I can manage my emotions at a different level. I've hired and trained tons of people by that point. So I'm more equipped to do that. I better understand processes and systems, you know? And so then that business explodes. And so it's like, you have to really extend the time horizon and realize like, you're probably not going to get it all right the first time. You might not get it right the second time or the third time. But if you keep building things, you will eventually internalize all these little skills mm-hmm. that then allow you to build something that can grow.
Mm-hmm. What I'm sure you're delegating a lot, right? And as you've said, you've matured and now you're much better as a leader, et cetera. What in your work do you, you know, obviously you make big decisions, et cetera, but what are you not delegating? What is core still? You've got multiple businesses. What do you not give to other people to do?
Admittedly, I think if you had asked me that question a year ago, I would have said a ton of stuff.
Yeah.
But admittedly, that has been a huge focus for us this past year. And I have been able to learn how to delegate a lot, you know, mm-hmm. like I think the next thing that I'm really working on learning how to delegate is learning how to train other people, especially department heads, on how to continuously improve something without me needing to be the one to point out what needs to be improved. You know, because especially when you have multiple businesses and you have multiple verticals within or departments within each business, it is very the hardest part about my job is context switching.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I could spend 8 hours digging into just the success vertical of PGA. And then if I change the context of that and I go, well, now let me dig into the sales component. It's a completely different way of thinking, completely different set of problems, completely everything's different. Mm-hmm. And then if I change that to, you know, front-end marketing and ads, well, that's completely different. And so the context switching is the most taxing part. And so a lot of what this year has been about is putting people in place that are in charge of each of those things. And then the next evolution will be, and then how do you train the people who are in charge of those things, how to look for areas of improvement over and over and over and over and over again, just like I would do, except now I don't have to be the one to do it. The thing can begin to grow on its own.
Mm-hmm. Does that make writings, sense? No, that makes complete sense. It's about like externalizing your taste kind of, and you're like trying to externalize your context and get people to understand the way you think.
Yeah. So much of it is documenting Like, it's not just, you know, here's your checklist to make sure Airtable is set up correctly, right? It's actually writing out, here's how to make decisions. Here's why we make decisions that way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. It's hard.
Yeah. On the subject of writing and delegating writing, I know that you do use some ghostwriters for your own content. And I also know that you are good at recycling content, right? Like, here's something I wrote a year ago. I think it's relevant now. Let's update it slightly and publish it again to all these platforms. So I'm curious the extent to which you're quite prolific on socials, right? The extent to which that is net new content and what goes into producing it and distributing it?
Yeah. So this is a fun and funny topic because I find that people have a lot of faulty beliefs when it comes to what you can do with the things that you write. Oftentimes people will say, like, you can't or you shouldn't take something that you wrote and then just post it again. Yeah. That will annoy the reader, right? And that would be like saying, well, once you read a book on your bookshelf, you're never allowed to read it again. You know,
it's also very egotistical. The reader doesn't remember what you posted. Right?
Yeah. Like, the reader doesn't remember. And the first time you posted it, you reached, you know, 500 people, 1,000 people. You did not reach everyone on the internet. Right. Mm-hmm. So much of my thesis when it comes to writing on the internet is based around this idea that no individual platform matters. You don't need to spend all this time figuring out, you know, the nuances to hack the algorithm of each individual platform. The most effective, highest leverage thing you could do over a long period of time is just focus on building a library of content in a niche that you want to write about for a very long time. The example I always use is, what is Ryan Holiday's niche? Mm-hmm. Ryan Holiday writes about Stoicism. He tweets about Stoicism. He has Medium articles about Stoicism. He has a newsletter about Stoicism. He has a YouTube channel about Stoicism. He has a podcast about Stoicism. And guess what? He's about to come out with another book about Stoicism, right? And so when you look at people who are really successful over long periods of time, the thing that they all share in common is that they created a massive library of content in a niche for 10 years, mm-hmm. 20 years. And if you take that approach, then every new platform, every new opportunity is just another channel for you to take your library and go, and now I put it over here too. So with that in mind, I have been writing about digital writing and writing on the internet and business models for writers. I've been writing about those things, self-publishing, for 10 years. Mm-hmm. So little insider, I'll pull the curtain back. I think 95% of the content that I put out on X, LinkedIn, Instagram, YouTube is a little bit of an outlier because it's like newer and I'm figuring that out.
But no, and it's you.
95, yeah. And it's me and I got to record the videos, but like the topics, the scripts, everything, 95% of it is a remixed version of something that I've written in the past. And I wasn't even the one who did it. So we now have a team, you know, that is trained on, all right, here's Cole's library. Here are the talking points. Here are the things that he hammers home. Here are his frameworks. Here are his stories. Just create a new version of it.
Yeah.
And I think, again, the faulty belief, like if the average person hears that, they're like, oh, so I'm not even reading you. But like you are. You're reading something that
a few times.
Yeah, do you know how many times I have written about how to find your niche as a writer?
I do, because I've been researching you for the past couple of days.
Like, I have written about it so many times that it if I have to write about it again, it is painful for me. But that doesn't mean that I should stop sharing it. That doesn't mean that I should stop putting it out. So what do our team of ghostwriters do? They go, well, Cole's written about this topic 1,000 times. I'm going to take a piece from this one, a piece from this one, a piece from this one. I'm going to smash them together in a new one, and then we're going to publish that. And that is what allows you to scale. That is like the whole thing that I'm trying to educate more and more founders and CEOs and investors and people with personal brands. You can't scale yourself. Like, do you think that, you know, the CEO of some $100 million company has the time to sit down and be like, I'm going to write all my tweets for the week. Then I'm going to create all my LinkedIn carousels for the week. That no, you need leverage. Mm-hmm. And the way that you get leverage without losing your voice and without losing your own stories and some of the things that make you in the writing is you focus on building a library over a prolonged period of time, and you have to learn how to work with a ghostwriter. And if you hire one, or you work with an agency or whatever it is, you have to learn how to work with a ghostwriter so that you can just speak. Mm-hmm. And then they can take the things that you say and you distribute them.
Yeah. So this is like an interesting topic in that I think the creator economy, right? There's people who are kind of the pure artist, often like journalism on one end, and then there are more the business people, marketers on one end. Basically people who kind of are doing the craft for the craft's sake and maybe reject some of the principles that would allow them to make a living doing it. And then there are some people on the other side who maybe are quite cynical, right, about the whole thing. One thing I like about your whole approach to this is you come from, going to school to do fiction writing, right? Like you come from that world, and then you have this story of like, well, shit, I got to make a living somehow, and it's not going to be this. And even in the way you were just describing that, right? Like, this is why I'm asking this. Like, you're good at putting some of these like good business practices into terms that are palatable for people who maybe don't come from that world but want to make a living doing this kind of thing, which is that's kind of the whole goal of this podcast, of this newsletter, of Creator Spotlight, right? Is like trying to make these entrepreneurial ideas palatable to people who otherwise would just be laboring forever without ever, going back and remixing the thing and distributing it. What do you find is like most effective? Like, I'm sure there's people who have, in your time educating people more one-on-one to early cohorts, right? Like, who are very skeptical about like, well, no, it's about the craft and that's what I care about. Like, what do you find is most effective in like helping those people understand like, no, you have to give some things up. You have to compromise if you want to make a living doing this.
So this is one of my favorite topics. And I think it's one of my favorites because I have spent a lot of time reflecting on my own journey of figuring that out for myself.
Yeah.
And I also think that it is something that holds a tremendous amount of creative potential in people from ever getting shared with the world and them actually achieving their potential. I fundamentally reject this idea that either you care deeply about the craft and you're this purist and all of the associations that you have with that, or you are just this like, money grubbing marketer that is just, you don't even care about the craft.
Yeah.
And whenever people talk about this topic, they talk about it in those two extremes. Okay. Mm-hmm. And the reason that I reject that is because, first of all, I spent a lot of years of my life being a broke purist, really, really frustrated that I was broke. And the irony of when you ask someone, why do you want to write? Why do you want to create? Why do you want to do what you do? The vast majority of people will give you the purest answer first, and they will say, I want to do what I love. It's fulfilling for me. I really care about it. And then if you wait 2 seconds later, they will complain about how they're not making any money from it. And so it actually is neither. The other point is that when I talk about things like leverage or working with a ghostwriter or remixing your content so that you get more distribution on your ideas, people will often immediately take what I'm saying and put me in that money grubbing marketer box and go, oh, Cole doesn't actually care about writing. He doesn't care about the craft. He just wants to make money. And the irony is that I think a lot of people really misunderstand how much I truly care about the craft of writing and how, even though I have all that leverage working for me, I still write 5,000 to 10,000 words a day. I still wake up at 5 a.m. and study literature. I still work on a dozen other book projects early in the morning or late at night on my own. And I think part of the reason why I feel so confident talking about building leverage and using these systems and working with ghostwriters and giving yourself that support to scale yourself as a writer or as a creator is because I know that if anybody questioned my ability and they were just like, oh, he's just doing that because he doesn't actually care. He doesn't care about the craft. I will get on Zoom with any person who questions that, and I will write whatever you want me to write in front of you for as long as you want me to write. If you want it in 15 minutes or if you want me sitting there for 15 hours, and you will watch me do it in front of you. Because I've put in that many, like literally like 20,000 hours.
Yeah.
And so that's because I've experienced this and I've learned this so viscerally. That's why I see this cognitive dissonance where people think it's either art or business. And it's not. It's that if you become business savvy, you have more time for art. You have more. I just finished I'm about to finish a fiction project that I've been working on for 2 years. I invested $100,000 of my own money into the audiobook of this fiction project. No publisher, no investors, nothing, just exactly what I wanted to create. And I put up my own money. So when people say, oh, like you're not a purist, it's like, no, I actually have the resources now to do all of the really cool things that I've always wanted to do. And you are giving yourself a cop out saying, I don't have to build these skills because I'm a purist. Okay. Well, what are you actually, do you get to write for 8 hours a day? No. So what are you gaining by saying that? And so I feel so, if you can't gather from my tone, I feel so strongly that these two extremes are just, they're holding people back, and you will find so much creative potential and freedom when you marry the two and realize artists can use the business to their advantage. And business people can use taking art to and using that to their advantage. And I just don't understand why these two worlds are kept so separate.
I 100% agree. I 100% agree. And I'm glad you went on this tirade about it. To me, it's like that's the key to success on the internet. I say the creator economy. You could say the intention economy, the information space. It all kind of blurs together, right? It's like you need to have both. You need to understand like how to write a sentence, and you also need to know what the acronym LTV means, right? It's kind of simple as that. If you want to have a big newsletter or something. Something that I saw you or your ghostwriters distributing across social media was this post, 10X writers are the new 10X software engineers, which I totally agree. I've been saying my own version of that recently. I just wrote a piece about it for Creator Spotlight, which is that learn marketing is the new learn to code. And maybe that learn marketing bit could use a bit of workshopping. Maybe it's just learn to be a good writer. But I'd love you to speak on that. This 10X writers are the new 10X software engineers idea.
Well, I mean, what's been fascinating watching ChatGPT and Claude and Gemini and all these new tools is how do we interact with all these tools? We don't interact with them. Well, I mean, you can, but the primary consumer way that you interact with these tools is not through code. It's through the English language. It's through a chat window. And so to me, like I remember when I first played with ChatGPT for the first time in 2022, 2021, I forget when it came out. I will never forget the first. Like, I didn't even mean to do it. I just sat down and intuitively started articulating, well, yeah, here's the thing that I'm looking for, and here's how I want you to create it. And I don't just want you to create it like this. I want you to follow these rules. And like instantly, I started getting high quality outputs. And I would look at other people using it, and they'd be like, oh, I it's all just slop. I can't get it to produce a high quality output. And to me, it seemed so intuitive. I was like, I've already written about this thing that I want 1,000 times. Now I'm just writing about it in a chat window and having some leverage. Now the technology can help me do it. And so over the past couple of years, as I've spent more and more time writing with AI, I've really realized that the bottleneck to using all of these platforms is your ability to write. Mm-hmm. And the bottleneck to writing effectively, this is like the part that everybody misses, is actually not all your knowledge about the craft of writing necessarily. The true bottleneck to writing effectively is your ability to think clearly and articulate the thing that you are trying to automate. You can't automate something that you can't articulate. And so it's like if writing wasn't an important skill before AI, it is now the most important skill. because A, that is how you interact with the tools, but B, because writing is the dominant vehicle for crystallizing your thinking. You can't automate something that you can't articulate.
Precisely. Another thing related to the conversation we were just having about the, you know, this false business craft divide. I'm going to summarize a story I heard you say in another podcast. So you were 27. You're working as a ghostwriter. You went to a lunch meeting in LA. The client was a crypto startup, and they were having you write a white paper. And you decided you're going to go big. You're going to charge $10K. You almost chicken out when it's time to say the price. You're about to go lower, but you say $10K, and the guy says, "Okay, $10K. We're going to do that because you told me that, but I was going to pay you up to $30K. I was prepared to pay you that much." And you told this story as an example of not understanding your value and not being able to articulate it to other people and being afraid to value yourself and to really figure out your place in the market. I know that this is probably part of your work. I don't know, in Premium Ghostwriting Academy is helping training people past this. What would you tell people who are currently going through that same problem of articulating their value?
Oh man, I have trained, I mean, we're probably coming up on 2,000 people have gone through PGA at this point. And I will tell you that 80% of the reason why people struggle to charge their worth, as they say, or just charge more, is not that they lack the ability to understand the hard skills. Like, yeah, there's some tactical stuff of here's how you should package your service. Here's how you should present what you do. You know, here's how you should speak to the problem that you're solving. Like that tactical stuff, very easy to teach someone. The hard part is everyone's relationship with money. And it is one of those things where what works for one person, like and what you say that can help someone overcome that faulty belief in them is different than what's going to work for another person, because each person has a different sort of relationship with money. And I find that the majority of what I do inside PGA is coaching people through how they think about their value and how they think about money. And every person goes through the same general process. You know, their nuances might be different, but the general process is when you first start providing any sort of service, you have a very hard time wrapping your head around how someone would pay you $1,000, right? You have no context for that number. And then if I tell you, well, no, you actually could charge $5,000, your brain explodes. You know, you can't do it. And what I've learned is it's a little bit like taking someone who's never been to the gym before. They've never picked up a weight ever in their whole life. And you walk up to the dumbbell rack and you jump to, all right, so why don't you grab the 40s? Why don't you grab the 50s? The person's going to freak out and they probably can't do it. Like their body literally, like they can't do it, right? So what do you have to do? You got to start them at the 10s. You got to slowly build them up, right? And there's a reason why almost every person that goes through PGA, I go, we're going to show you how to ghostwrite a 5-day educational email course. You're going to pitch it to a business owner and you're going to pitch it for $5,000. And almost every single person can't get the words $5,000 out of their mouth. And so what they do is they revert back because they have some sort of faulty relationship with money. And so they revert back and they go, I charged $1,000. Client, of course, is going to say yes to that because they're like, wow, this person's really undercharging. And then and what happens is it's the same, you know, metaphor as the gym is they start with $1,000. Then they sit there and they're like, wait, I could have charged more. Why did I do that? They gain a little bit of confidence. They're like, next time I'm gonna charge $1,500. Then next time I'm gonna charge $2,000. The next time I'm gonna charge $2,500. And I find that a lot of people, the only way to really overcome these faulty beliefs around money or what you feel like you can charge is by undercharging and then realizing how frustrated you feel because you just signed yourself up for something that you could have charged more for. And if eventually, most people get frustrated. This was my experience too. Most people get frustrated undercharging for so long where eventually they snap and they go, all right, fine, I'm just going to say the higher number. You know, they almost do it to spite me. They're like, fine, cool, I've had enough. I'm going to say the higher number. And then they do. And then the client says yes. And then they're like, why didn't I do that the whole time? So there's, there, it is a, It is a very emotional thing. And of course, everybody wants to believe that, oh, I can just figure that out on my own. But that's not what happens. You know, what happens is they try and then they fail or they run into some friction and then they question themselves and then they talk themselves out of doing it and then they give up. You know, that is fundamentally why we build PGA the way that we did, because the value isn't just saying, here, you should package your services like this.
Yeah.
The value is they package their services like this. They go to a client, the client says something, and then they freak out. And we go, don't freak out. It's okay. Do this instead, you know?
Yeah, totally. Which, I mean, brings me back to a thought on education, on like the conversation on educational products we were having at the beginning of this conversation, which is that like what makes a good educational product and what makes your information education products popular and gives them a good reputation is this sort of hands-on nature, the relationship with instructors, the relationship between students, right? Like that's kind of the mistake, is thinking that it's about the information itself. It's about the relationships with other people in this context.
Yeah. I mean, I would say, you know, don't get it twisted. Obviously there's information and education that people find extremely valuable.
But you need
valuable.
The other people to activate it, right?
But yes. I would say generally our thesis and perspective is we want to wrap education in community. We want to wrap it in accountability. Mm-hmm. We want to wrap it in either people or systems that increase the likelihood that a student is successful. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, we don't promise this, but we've had students join PGA as a complete beginner and a year later now are running ghostwriting agencies of their own, doing 50, 60, 70, 80, 90 grand a month.
Yeah.
You know? And so it's all of these things are possible. The thing that I tell every writer is it's not do these things work or not. It's not are these things possible or not. The question is, are you willing to go on the journey to make them work for you?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so
if you go to the gym and you go every day, you're going to get stronger. It's just a matter of if you're going to go show up and lift some weights.
Yeah. And if you're not going to show up, I can give you all the answers, but it's not going to do anything, you know?
Yeah, no, totally. So your books, we haven't talked about your books really. You said you're publishing a new fiction book soon. You've published a memoir, a few fiction books, a few nonfiction books. I think one of yours, The Art and Business of Online Writing, right? Or is it The Art and Business of Writing Online? Mm-hmm. I think it sold over 40,000 copies. Your Amazon publishing account recently got shut down. I was just checking. I think it might be back up. But you also tweeted the other day that you are considering republishing it in 2026 to the point we were making earlier about, you know, refreshing the thing and adding new bits. But what are some of the new ideas that you would be stressing in this new edition for 2026? What are the new rules, new patterns?
I remember when I wrote The Art and Business of Online Writing in 2020, and I knew, you know, the challenge with a topic like that is the writing landscape does change.
Moving,
you know,
target.
There is a timeliness aspect of it. But I didn't want the book to be timely. I didn't want it to be relevant just for a year. So I tried to write as much of it as possible, sharing these principles that are never going to change. You know, like the way that you think about headlines or the way that you write hooks or the way that you format your write. Like those things are really not going to change all that much.
Boron letters type shit.
Yeah. And if I do a re-released version, I think some of the pieces that I would tweak would be platforms. Like when I wrote that book, one of the platforms that I stressed was Quora. And Quora in the late 2010s was an amazing platform. Today, less so. I think that platform has really gone down. The founders, I could spend a whole hour talking about the decisions they made, but
let me turn over the hourglass.
Quora is not what it used to be.
Yeah.
Same thing with Medium. You know, in 2018, 2019, Medium was an amazing channel. Today, not at all. You get almost no distribution on Medium. My recommendations more today would be X and LinkedIn are tremendous, you know, traffic vehicles for your writing. Substack and Substack Notes, I think, is very interesting. Beehive and the different business model things that you guys are doing with the ad network and pairing sponsors with newsletters. I find that to be very interesting, especially because that removes a lot of operational complexity for creators, you know, people that don't want to do those things themselves. So there have been new tools and new things that would be worth speaking to, but yeah, I don't know that I want to make that a thing where, okay, well, I'm updating this every 5 years. Maybe I haven't decided yet. I actually have another art and business book that I want to prioritize writing first. And so my goal is to ship that out in 2026. And then if I have some time, maybe I'll go back.
Art and business of what?
It's going to be the art and business of category copywriting.
Mm.
So it's all about, I think that copywriting is probably one of the most misunderstood words in all of writing. And the vast majority of people who are in copywriting actually have no idea what game they're actually playing.
Yeah.
Everyone calls everything copywriting. And category copywriting is this idea of specifically writing things to differentiate yourself from any competitors. It is how you create a niche or a category for yourself. And I've never seen anyone write about this topic. I've kept a note on my phone for the past 5 years of just like examples I see out in the world. So I'm really excited about this one.
Okay, well, stay tuned. Last thing. I know that you keep like a dozen books or so on your desk at once, and you're, you know, constantly reading through bits and pieces of each one. What are one or two books that you've particularly enjoyed recently?
Let's see.
What's on the desk?
Let's see. What do we have right here? I've got. We've got Something to Do with Paying Attention, which was a. Like an excerpt of a novel in progress by David Foster Wallace.
Oh, nice.
Which was published after he died. It's very chaotic, but I really like the voice in it. This was a book I read in college that I'm rereading called Body, written by Harry Cruz. And it's about this guy who trains this woman to win this bodybuilding competition. It's awesome. It's very literary. He's a great, like, very gritty type of writer. He's just a fantastic writer. I'm super into it. I was rereading Robert Greene's Mastery recently.
Nice.
I love this book. This book, like, changed my life when I graduated from college. And this book really inspired me to start taking writing, like, really, really seriously. And I read that and then started writing on Quora. And then here we are.
There you go.
I'm rereading my first memoir, Confessions of a Teenage Gamer, because
how's that? How's that experience?
Honestly, I still think it's the best thing I've ever written. Yeah. It is so.
You spent 4 years on it, right?
It's so good. Yeah. And you can tell it's so good. And in 2026 will be the 10-year anniversary. I published this 10 years ago. And so I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to re-release it with a new cover and sort of celebrate the 10-year anniversary, because I love this book. And then lastly, I started reading The Art of Spending Money by Morgan Housel.
Mm-hmm.
Not bad. And then I'm also reading The Glass Bead Game by Hermann Hesse, which is a classic.
I've read, of course, Siddhartha. Yeah. I think Damien's by him too. I read that one, but I haven't read him for a while. Nice. I'm currently reading Shadow Ticket, the new Pynchon.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, really good
nice.
Stuff.
Yeah, always looking for new reads.
Yeah, I'll share some more after we turn it off. But cool, thank you for coming on. This was fun.
This was great. Good questions. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Of course. Got to bring the questions. All right, that's it. Listener, we'll see you next week.
If you enjoyed the episode and are interested in writing online, one of the best ways you can do that is with a newsletter, which is why I recommend watching this episode next with Nathan May. Nathan runs a newsletter growth agency, and he gives away tons of great information in this episode about how to grow and monetize a newsletter. It's a great episode. Give it a watch next.